knew what you were doing, didn't he? Dr. Finley got a distant look in his eyes, almost a pained expression. Sam was a dear friend, and he supported us from the start. He saw the greater good. And by us, you mean Navarro and Goodwin? Dr. Finley scoffed. Sandra, yes, but Evan, no. That boy is a flea whom I utterly despise, as does Sandra. But he's a good soldier, and he does as Sandra says, unlike you. Carrie felt nauseated all over again. Turfing. Sandra Goodwin had fostered the perfect work culture to make these patients disappear. When these vets leave the floor, they become other people's problems, Carrie said almost to herself. Navarro never bothered to look at the number of medical complications associated with DBS. To him, it was just one less thing to worry about. So you killed Sam because why? He didn't want to play along?
So to speak, Dr. Finley said. But believe me, I did not want to hurt him. Same as I don't want to hurt you. Sam left me no choice. I do have a heart, Carrie. We could have killed him when the accident didn't.
Dr. Finley put the word accident inside air quotes.
But I told Braxton to leave him be. In his condition, his family at least had a sprig of hope for his recovery, and he was no threat to me.
Until he woke up.
A dark cloud crossed Dr. Finley's face. If you hadn't been on your way to see him, we might have been able to handle it differently. As it was, you forced us to improvise. Why couldn't you have just done your job and inserted those wires while we did the rest?
That's not who I am.
That, I'm afraid, was my miscalculation. Now I need to know, besides David Hoffman, who else have you told?
Cold terror seeped into Carrie's bones. No, not David. He doesn't know anything.
Dr. Finley returned an annoyed look. Don't play me for a fool, he said. Who else have you told?
Carrie would not answer.
Your entire family is in danger now, Carrie. Be honest here. Who else have you told?
Go screw yourself.
Carrie bent down, grabbed the empty blue bucket beside her, and hurled it as hard as she could against the wire. The bucket bounced back and nearly hit her in the face before it clattered noisily to the ground.
Dr. Finley turned his attention to Braxton.
Come with me to the lab. I'd like to have a word with you in private before we go and deal with Mr. Hoffman.
Braxton showed Carrie a syringe.
I used this to take care of Sam Rockwell after I ran you off the road, he said, a cold glint in his eyes.
Ruefully, he added,
Guess I should have taken you out that day after all.
Dr. Finley took a single step toward the exit, but turned back to address Carrie once more.
I'm so sorry it's come to this, he said. I really thought we could continue our efforts with you on board. The thought of landing a top-notch neurosurgeon so soon after we dealt with Sam was simply out of the question. I figured we'd have to go dark for some time, but then you came along, like a miracle, really. The timing honestly could not have been better. And given your past, well, I assumed you'd follow the rules and just do your job. Insert wires, go home. Why would you rock the boat? You should have been the ultimate good soldier, Carrie. Sandra was right about you. You really were a loose cannon all along.
Braxton followed Dr. Finley to the exit. What are you going to do with me? Carrie yelled.
Dr. Finley turned to Braxton.
He was your friend.
Braxton looked over at Carrie and then to Bushman.
Shooting an unarmed woman inside a cage isn't really my style. Bushman, kill the bitch.
Bushman's eyes flared as he took a pistol from an ankle holster.
As you wish, he said.
Braxton and Dr. Finley disappeared through an exit door. The vet's mumbling flooded Carrie's ears once again. Bushman and Hernandez consulted one another for a bit, out of Carrie's earshot. When Bushman approached, he had venom in his eyes. Then he softened. For a second, Carrie thought he was going to let her go.
It won't hurt, I promise, he said, almost apologetically.
Carrie fell to her knees as tears streamed down her face.
Any last words? Hernandez asked.
Carrie began to convulse. The fear, the pure terror of knowing these were her final few seconds, overwhelmed her. She really had no way out. Death had come for her. In that moment, Carrie's resolve thickened.
She caught her breath and with great effort fixed her gaze on Bushman. She would not die with her eyes closed. She would stare into the face of her killer. It was the last bit of humanity she had left. Bushman's outstretched arm was like a steel rod. The pistol in his hand did not waver.
"Do you have anything to say?" Bushman asked.
"Yeah. Get the fuck away from my sister."
Carrie heard an enormous bang, a bright flash of light that came from her right. In the very next instant, Terry Bushman's entire head vanished inside an explosion of blood, brains, and bone. Chapter 59. All Carrie could see was the blur of her brother, Adam, as he charged into the room, his rifle aimed at Ramon Hernandez. Bushman had crumpled to the floor, his face no longer recognizable beneath a gruesome crimson mask. The gun tumbled from Bushman's lifeless hand and skidded close to Fasciani's cage, far out of Carrie's reach. Several flashes erupted from the barrel of Adam's rifle, but Hernandez dropped to the floor with startling quickness, and as he did, removed a pistol from his holster.
"Look out, Adam!" Carrie screamed.
As she spoke those words, bright flashes erupted from Hernandez's gun aimed in Adam's direction. Trapped inside their cages, the vets reacted to the sudden tumult as though they were part of the action. Some took cover, while others held up their arms and fired make-believe weapons at invisible targets. With his feet in constant motion, Adam zigzagged using quick cuts that avoided the hail of bullets. The muffled pops from Hernandez's weapon rang out in the hollow enclosure. Feeling helpless beyond measure, Carrie grabbed the chain-link wire of her prison cell and pulled futilely, watching the scene unfold as if in slow motion. Adam, sure-footed and dexterous, veered left, then right in a series of sharp turns that closed the gap between him and Hernandez considerably. Seeking protection, Adam took shelter behind one of the many thick concrete support columns and opened a line of fire at Hernandez, who immediately returned volley. Bright flashes hindered her vision, but Carrie saw a few bullets fired by Hernandez smack into the concrete column that shielded her brother. Several more hit the ground near Adam's feet. Hernandez's fire paused, during which Adam leaned out and got off several shots. Adam had a pistol strapped to his waist, but he seemed to prefer the accuracy of his rifle. Of the six or so shots Adam fired, one hit the intended target. A geyser of blood erupted from Hernandez's punctured arm. He let out a savage scream. Clamping his hand over the wound, Hernandez found cover by the tall pile of detritus laundry machines discarded nearby. For the moment, at least, he was out of Adam's direct firing line. Adam let fly several shots, but those did nothing against Hernandez's massive steel barricade. To Carrie's horror, Adam unsheathed an enormous bowie knife from an ankle holster and slipped out from behind the protection of the support column. Holding the rifle one-handed, Adam fired several more shots designed to hold Hernandez in place. He set the rifle on the ground without making a sound. His finger went to his lips, urging Carrie's silence. Adam approached the fortification of laundry machines stealthily, taking quick steps. Hernandez may have been reloading or recovering during the short respite, which allowed Adam to reach the barricade without incident. With a sudden burst of motion, Adam shot forward and ascended the metal mountain with the skill and grace of a ram. Hernandez, sensing immediate danger, came up from his hiding place and raised his weapon to fire. At that same instant, Adam reached the top of the pile and he leapt down on Hernandez, arms and legs spread-eagled, the knife clutched in his hand like a deadly talon. The two entangled men vanished behind the metal mound, out of Carrie's sight. When they finally emerged, Adam had the knife poised over Hernandez's head, pressing with all his might. Hernandez grimaced as he parried the knife attack with his right hand, while his left clutched Adam's throat. The two men tussled and spun in a violent ballet. Adam's color began to change, alarming red to terrifying blue, and the strength of his arm began to fade. Hernandez managed to bend the wrist enough to turn the blade against Adam. Then Hernandez applied tremendous pressure that bent the arm and inched the blade closer to Adam's heart. Adam grunted and snorted as he tried to battle back. The blade still moved closer.
"No!"
Carrie screamed. But there was no stopping it now. Hernandez plunged the knife into Adam's chest, burying it up to the hilt. Adam's mouth fell open, but no sound escaped. As he stumbled backward, Adam used his right hand to retrieve the pistol from its holster. He flicked his wrist and fired a shot that struck Hernandez in the stomach. Adam shot again, in the heart this time, and Hernandez went slack as his eyes bugged out.
They fell on top of each other, and Adam fired two more times into the stomach area. The bullets exploded out Hernandez's back and made his body jump as if it had been electrocuted. Adam rolled Hernandez off of him and fished a ring full of keys from the dead man's pockets. With great exertion, Adam staggered to his feet, with the knife still protruding from his chest. Tears streamed down Carrie's face as Adam stumbled toward her cage. Blood sputtered from Adam's throat, painting the floor with bright red dots. He fumbled with the keys, but dropped to his knees before he could put one in the lock. Carrie fell to the floor with him and stuck her hands through the wire to hold her brother upright. She moved her hands up a few holes in the wire to caress Adam's bloodstained face. His body listed from side to side, unsteady in her grasp, as if he were being tossed by waves.
Adam, Adam, what are you doing here? Oh, Adam.
I followed you. Been following you. The rasp in Adam's voice, the rattle in his chest, cleaved Carrie's heart.
Carrie recalled the Camaro she had seen in her rearview mirror. She thought little of it, but the car had belonged to her brother.
I saw you, Carrie said.
Adam broke into that trademark smile of his, but this time flashed Carrie teeth that were stained blood red.
You followed them, Adam managed, and I followed you. Protect you. Finally, got the damn car working. Didn't tell you, I told nobody. Didn't want you to spot me. Guess you did anyway.
There were certainly opportunities for Adam to come and go without anybody at home to notice. Maybe her parents had seen his car was gone, but with her phone shut off, they had no way to reach her. Adam's eyes glazed over.
No, Carrie whimpered, and she held on tighter. Don't you die on me. Don't you do it.
Love you, sis,
Adam said. It was obvious that incredible strength was required for Adam to push the keyring toward Carrie's cage.
Get out. Get out of here.
No. I'm not letting go.
Adam glanced down at the knife buried in his chest.
I am, he said. I am.
And with that, Adam's body went limp. The eyes Carrie had seen, full of both laughter and rage, turned glassy and vacant. His expression, drained, became nearly serene. Carrie sobbed and stretched through the wire to clutch her brother in her arms. She was still holding on to him when Braxton Price and Dr. Finley returned to the laundry room and saw the incredible carnage. Price drew his gun and took aim at Carrie, who would not for a second let go of her brother. She put her head up against the wire, desperate to feel more connected to Adam. Her eyes closed, and she waited for death to come.
They don't pay me enough, Price said.
A gunshot rang out, and then another. Carrie looked just as a bullet lodged dead center into Price's skull. Price went limp, and he dropped to the ground like a marionette separated from its strings. A third gunshot sounded. This one hit Dr. Finley in the neck. Clutching the wound, Dr. Finley spun around in frantic circles, blood spewing through his fingers, spraying in all directions, a look of horror on his face. He tumbled to the floor near Price's inert body, where he convulsed and gurgled on the blood that now filled his throat, until his spasms stopped and he went perfectly still. Confused by who had fired, Carrie turned her head in the direction of those gunshots. She saw Eric Fasciani on his feet in a firing stance, Ivy in his arm, holding Bushman's smoking pistol in his right hand. Fasciani looked over at Carrie and said,
Sergeant, Sergeant, I got two confirmed kills here. That's two confirmed kills.
Epilogue. Only certain sections of the Arlington Cemetery allow private headstone markers to be placed. Adam's marker was a simple design, dignified and appropriate for a military setting. The inscription was factual, name, rank, date of birth, date of death, and a short phrase that required special approval. It read, Remember those with invisible wounds. Spring days, like this 70-degree delight in mid-April, are seldom so spectacular, and the warm breeze made the freshly bloomed cherry blossoms smell even sweeter. The cemetery was mostly deserted at that midday hour, except for Howard and Irene Bryant, who were walking arm in arm back to their rental car parked nearby, and for David and Carrie, who lingered behind, holding hands, gazing at Adam's gravestone with somber expressions. Carrie clutched in her hand the qualification number from her recent running of the Boston Marathon. She put the number on the grass in front of Adam's grave and used a rock she'd brought with her to hold it in place. When she stood, her eyes were filled with tears, and she clutched David's hand for comfort. "I didn't do great, little brother," Carrie said, her voice cracking with emotion. "But I finished. Can't believe we lived in Hopkinton all those years and never bothered to run the big race. Well, I ran it for you. For Steve, for Eric, for all the vets. I raised about $2,000 for the Red Sox's home base program, too, which I guess is pretty good. It'll help other vets suffering from PTSD, so I hope you're pleased." Carrie's throat closed. She tried to take a breath, but a sob came out instead. It took time before she could speak again. When she did, her voice was soft and it trembled. "I miss you every day. And I love you so very much," Carrie said through her gathering tears. "So, here's the big news Mom and Dad told you I was going to share. Sandra Goodwin was finally sentenced today. That's really why we came down. I wanted to be here when it happened so I could tell you personally. It took a year for the trial," Carrie said. "Can you believe it's been a year? Well, she's going to spend the rest of her life in prison for what she did. Cal Trent and Bob Richardson, well, their trials are still underway, but they'll get the same. Don't you worry about it." Carrie fished a tissue from her purse and used it to wipe away the tears. She remembered something else to tell her brother. "They found a burial site. Buried. Burned." Carrie had heard all about the gruesome details of the killings since she became close with the new Secretary of Veterans Affairs. There had been 11 killings, they thought, but it could be more. Bodies turned to ash. The former secretary had resigned in disgrace, along with the medical director at the Boston VA, even though he claimed no involvement with Dr. Finley's program, no knowledge that DARPA's blood money founded a nightmare factory. "Not much new to report on Eric's condition, or the others," Carrie said. "They're still suffering significant neurological damage. But the irony is, Dr. Finley might have been onto something all along. We've gone through his case files, and there's something there. Using DBS to cure PTSD is not so far-fetched after all." Carrie's composure cracked again, and she took a moment to recover. David gripped her hand tighter, but the heavy sadness felt like a boulder on her chest. "I know it sounds horrible to say, but I'd rather you and the others didn't die in vain. And I guess on that note, I have some more good news to share. I matched with a residency program at the Cleveland Clinic. I'll be starting in September, and they want me to continue work on treating PTSD and other trauma using DBS. I've given this a lot of thought, and I've decided I'm not going to back away. There's an answer to the problem, a way to do the treatment that's safe and effective. It'll take years and lots of hard work to figure it out, but the effort will pay off one day, I know it. What these people did was horrible, beyond words. But I'm choosing to blame the doctors, not the medicine." Carrie leaned her head on David's shoulder as a strong wind kicked up. She brushed the hair from her face and gave a strained smile. "I feel the wind. Is that you talking, Adam? I sure hope so. I hope you approve. Anyway, I think about you every day. Mom and Dad do too. We all love you so much." Carrie shut her eyes tight, but those tears leaked out anyway. After a few minutes, she and David turned and walked over to where Howard and Irene stood, and all four embraced. "We'll meet you for dinner later," Irene asked, dabbing at her eyes with a handkerchief. "Yeah," Carrie said. "Just text me the place and the time and we'll be there." Howard leaned over to kiss Carrie on the forehead and pulled her into his arms. "I love you so much, kiddo," he said in a shaky voice. "I'm so proud to call you my daughter." Carrie hugged her father hard as she ever had. Then they were apart, two pairs headed for separate cars. Howard and Irene got into their sedan while Carrie climbed into the driver's seat of Adam's fire-red Camaro, with David taking the passenger seat beside her. The car had made the long journey from Hopkinton to D.C. without one mechanical problem. Evidently, Adam needed inspiration to get it working right, and watching out for his sister's safety had provided more than enough. Carrie fired up the engine and started to drive when David's cell phone rang.
"David here,"
he answered. There was a long series of pauses as David said things like,
"Uh-huh. Oh, good. Yeah, sure. Of course. That sounds fine. Of course."
He ended the call and said nothing. Carrie looked over at him. "Well?"
"Well, what?"
David asked. "Who called?"
"Annika from the Lowell Observer."
"What about?"
"The Pulitzer," David said. "I won."
Carrie laughed. "That's how you celebrate?"
"Not a real celebratory occasion, and it's a story I wish I didn't have to write."
"David, it's fantastic news. I'm so proud of you. I really am." Carrie used one hand to drive and the other to give David's hand a squeeze.
"There's more," David said. "I've apparently been offered an assignment for the New York Times. They want me to go to Sierra Leone for a couple months."
"Oh, my. That sounds dangerous."
"I'm a stringer, Carrie. I go where the story is."
Carrie pulled her hand away and focused on the road.
"What?" David asked.
"I'm moving to Cleveland soon," Carrie said. "We haven't really talked about us, and now you're going away." David smiled and touched Carrie's face with much tenderness.
"I'm a stringer," he said. "I go where the story is. And you're the story I want to follow for the rest of my life."
Carrie took David's hand and this time gave it a kiss. She pressed down on the gas and the Camaro shot forward like a rocket ship. For a moment, Carrie felt Adam's presence in the seat behind her, his hand resting on her shoulder, a broad grin on his face, that twinkle in his eyes. And on she drove. She drove.
Now listen to an interview with the author.
Hi, this is Laura Wilson, executive producer at Macmillan Audio, and I'm speaking with Daniel Palmer. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, we're obviously very excited to be producing Trauma as an audio, and of course publishing it as a book. And I know it must be a little bit hard because you're obviously working on a book that you worked on with your father, who's sadly no longer with us. Was it hard to take over the writing?
Well, it was on a certain level, and then on another level, it was actually really helpful in the grieving process. I felt throughout the writing that my dad was kind of with me and kind of, you know, helping to guide the story. I learned writing from my father. I learned the craft from my father. So his lessons had stuck with me, and I was able to really tap into a lot of his teachings as I was going through the story, as I was going through his notes and going through kind of his vision and thought, well, what would Dad do here? How would he handle this? What would he say? How would I increase the drama? How would I build more conflict? How would I make this story as much of a Michael Palmer story as I possibly could? And so as I was thinking about him and doing that, I actually realized, you know, I feel like my dad, part of my dad is still here. He's still with me and still with his fans, with his many readers. And that was a blessing.
Well, it's really interesting that you say that because, I mean, obviously it sounds like it was amazing to be able to do, but also I know that you write your own books. And so it must have been a very interesting process for you to be sort of channeling your father in one of a book that's sort of his also.
Yeah, my novels are very different than a Michael Palmer story in a certain regard. You know, the themes aren't medical for what I do, but yet we pull from the same kind of material. In terms of the craft, these books are comprised of the same essential elements. There's the protagonist. We both believe. And really, he taught me that the idea of a story, what makes a story work, what makes the reader turn the page, isn't so much what happens next, although that's what the reader thinks they're reading the story for, it's really that they've grown to care about the characters and care about their situations. And so that applied to my, you know, I applied those lessons to my books, the ones I write just as Daniel Palmer. And of course, you know, I tried to follow the playbook of how a Michael Palmer story would evolve as closely as I possibly could while working on Trauma.
And I know you mentioned that your novels that you write on your own, obviously, are non-medical. They're not medical thrillers. Was that hard for you to enter that world?
Yeah. It was really fascinating. In both Trauma and my own books, the protagonist is really an ordinary person. The goal of pretty much all of my characters, and I would hasten to say almost all of my father's protagonists as well, is to be happy. That's the primary goal that these people have. And as the writer, I put these obstacles in their way to make them unhappy. A huge obstacle that I had was the medicine. I am not a doctor. I've never gone to medical school. And I knew, and a challenge that I had going, you know, looking at this book and looking at what was laid out in front of me is my dad was going back to kind of his roots. He was bringing this book back to the hospital where he got kind of his career started. There was a number of books that he did over the years, starting really with The First Patient, moving on Second Opinion and The Fifth Vial and then Oath of Office, Political Suicide. A lot of these books were kind of medical political thrillers and touched on both issues. And this book was really about the hospital. And so I had to rely on experts. And I just so happened to come from a family of doctors. And one of the experts was somebody who was very, very close to my dad. It was my mother's brother, my uncle. And he stepped in and really helped guide a lot of what I did and a lot of the medicine. And my job was to take the information, which came in at fire hose speed, and distill it down so that the reader wouldn't get lost in the medical jargon. This was something my father did very, very well. He could bring you into the operating room and make you feel that moment and make you feel kind of that what was happening, like almost like you're watching an episode of ER. And I wanted to be able to do that. So I wanted to take the information and find what is the right way to distill it and to then share it with the readers. And I think without my uncle's help, I would have really struggled. But without my father's tutelage and without kind of templates from his other novels that I was able to look at, I don't know if I would have been successful. And I truly hope that with Trauma, I've done that. And, you know, if you read the first few chapters, I think you'll come away going, wow, Daniel Palmer could do brain surgery. And I promise you, I can't. Everything I know about brain surgery is in those chapters.
It's really cool. And it must have been really interesting to get a much closer relationship with your father's, you know, sort of other job, his medical job, because, you know, obviously you knew him as both a doctor and a writer. But to have to really delve into, you know, your parents go off to work, you don't really have to pay that much attention to what they're doing when they're at work until you have to really, you know, describe it and delve into the details.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, I have such a new appreciation for doctors. And I always had it, you know, with my dad, and I saw him do certain things. I mean, you know, as a doctor, I've done the, you know, kind of that take your kid to work day, and I've gone to the ER with him, and I've seen him stitch people up, and I did have kind of an understanding of it. But as I expanded my knowledge of the medical profession, and I got into more of different types of medicine, surgeons and the like, I just developed an entirely new appreciation for how much goes into it and how much these doctors and nurses as well are putting themselves completely and totally into their jobs, because their jobs are life and death. You know, sometimes I feel like when I'm doing research, I just did research at a critical care facility, and I left feeling like, my goodness, I have a toy for a job, because these people are dealing with life and death situations every minute of every day. and I definitely want to try to capture as best I can what they do and how they do it, so that, you know, the respect I have for the profession can be translated and translate onto the page.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, and you definitely get that feeling when you're reading a Michael Palmer book, that feeling of being in the world of healthcare professionals. You also had to write from the, not from the point of view always, but you know, sort of walk in the shoes of a female character. I don't know if that's something you've done before in your other books, or if this was your first time doing that.
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, that might be my first female protagonist. You know, what was different about it for me? I think the differences may be subtle. You know, in terms of, I think between men and women, again, we all want the same things. We want to be happy. We want to feel successful. We want to feel fulfilled. You know, were there issues or kind of emotions that I tried to tap into that I thought, well, you know, how might a woman approach this, or how might a woman think about this challenge? You know, in some ways, I know as much about that as I do about medicine. So, you know, there was definitely a lot of work and thought that went into trying to make Carrie Bryan, who is this young, brash neurosurgeon who finds herself suddenly in this terrible situation, a horrible fall from grace, trying to find her center again. A lot of work went into making her a fully realized person, and you know, I definitely pulled from the women in my life and tried my very best to represent her as both strong and vulnerable. And you know, in a lot of ways, I do that with my male protagonists as well.
And obviously, you've mentioned your father as a very powerful influence on you as a writer. Are there other thriller writers or writers in general that you've looked to that you think have influenced you in some way or inspired you in some way?
Oh, for sure. You know, I'm very fortunate to be involved with International Thriller Writers, ITW, which is an organization of thriller writers from all over the globe. And through that organization, I've met a lot of my heroes. You know, between Harlan Coben and Lisa Gardner, Lee Child, Robert Crace, list can go on. Joe Finder is another one. You know, these are people whose books, you know, line my shelves, and whose stuff I look for every time it comes out. I was very lucky the other day, not too long ago. My dad, he taught me when I was a little kid, I was 10 years old maybe, he taught me how to play the blues harmonica. And I really took to it and played all the time. And over the years, I actually got pretty good. And I've dreamed about playing a gig with the Rock Bottom Remainders, just to play a song with this band, because so many of my literary heroes were in the band. Stephen King and Greg Iles come to mind. There's Ridley Pearson and Dave Barry, who, you know, whose stuff I've read and I've loved, Mitch Albom. So there's all Amy Tan's in it as well. And so I had this dream of playing with them. And just a few weeks ago, I got to go to the Tucson Festival of the Book. The Remainders were playing, and I got on stage, and there I was playing harmonica, an instrument my father taught me, next to some of my absolute favorite writers in the world. So that was just a true treat.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. That must have been an amazing time. I've heard that they exist, but I've never seen them perform. So I can imagine.
Their album is titled, I think their one album is titled Hard to Listen. So that gives you an idea of the band. But they were actually, surprisingly to me, really great. And it was one of the best nights. Just I had a total gas.
That's amazing. And you have worked as a musician, I mean, not just with that.
Yeah, before I was a fiction writer, I was a songwriter. I've recorded two CDs. I've licensed songs to some different companies. One I licensed to J. Crew. So I've had a little, you know, a dabble of success at songwriting, but it's a, you know, was an industry and a pursuit I didn't really go into wholeheartedly. It was a hobby, but it was a really wonderful hobby. And it wasn't until I started writing fiction, long form fiction, that I realized my years of songwriting actually helped me with fiction writing. That there were elements of songwriting that really ported over to fiction writing. As an example, the first line in a song is hugely important, and so is the first line in a novel. That you want with your songs to be clear but interesting, and you want the same thing with your book as well. And so the times I spent crafting novels, I feel have greatly influenced just my ability to craft, or crafting songs has greatly influenced my ability to craft a novel.
That's fascinating. It's something I never would have thought of. One last question, and because I'm, you know, an audiobooks producer, I have to ask everyone, are you an audiobook listener yourself?
I am. I love listening to audiobooks while I exercise. So I put the earphones on and off I go for a run, and I've done Dan Brown's book, what was the last, you know, Stephen King, like some long books, Ken Follett. I love how it just creates images in my mind, especially just really great audio narrators create wonderful, wonderful images. I have a really funny story about an audiobook that I'll share with you. That I was at the Newbery Book Festival in Newburyport, Massachusetts. So I guess the Newburyport Literary Festival. And I was invited to a party at the house of André Debout III, who is a fabulous writer. If you haven't read André's stuff, he's tremendous. And he's a big time guy in the Newburyport Festival. So we're at the party, and a guy introduces himself, or says, asks me if I want something. And I said, yeah, you know, could you, if you're going into the kitchen, could you grab me something to drink? And he asked me my name, and I said, I'm Daniel Palmer. And he goes, wait, do you write suspense novels? And I said, yeah, I do. And he goes, my name's Peter Burkrot. I'm your audio guy. I'm the voice of your books. And we just had the best laugh about that.
So here I am,
randomly meeting the guy who voiced my novels, and we talked for a while about that, and it's just fascinating to me how he really takes on the different personalities of the characters, and how one person can create the entire world as an audio listener. I think it's an incredible format, and I'm thrilled at the growth. I know it's been growing leaps and bounds.
Yeah, that's a great story, number one. I work with Peter a lot. He's wonderful. And I'll be sure to tell him that you told that story. Well, we couldn't end on a better note, because that was wonderful. So thank you very, very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and thank you. And I hope everyone who listens enjoys Trauma.
This is Exie Sands. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Trauma by Michael Palmer and Brian Palmer, a Macmillan Audio production for St. Martin's Press. Text copyright 2015 by Michael Palmer. Production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved. Chapter 21. The house was quiet when Carrie got home. The front porch light was on. It was always on when Carrie stayed out after her parents had gone to sleep. Traffic on the Mass Pike had been mercifully light, but it was still almost midnight when Carrie pulled into her parents' driveway. She'd spent the drive running Abington's surgical procedure through her mind. It had been an exhilarating, terrifying, and utterly strange first day on the job, and she was glad to be home. Carrie had given some thought to moving out now that she had an income stream again, but opted against it. Until she had some permanence, she was not going to make any big changes. When Carrie walked into the kitchen, she was delighted to find a card waiting for her on the table, propped against a small vase of flowers, daisies mostly,
her favorite. The handwritten note from her mom and dad congratulated her on what they assumed had been a successful first surgery. She had debated telling them about Abington, but worried they would worry. Reading her parents' note, Carrie became keenly aware of the soreness around her neck. It was tight, and every time she looked to the left, she felt a sharp, gripping pain that stretched across the back of her head. It was the pain of a muscle spasm, not a fracture. She also had additional pain along the outside of her right knee, but not with every step. In the morning, she'd probably wake up with visible signs of the day's violence. Those would need to be explained, or perhaps just covered up. Carrie heard a floorboard creak behind her and turned to see Adam in the entrance to the kitchen. He was wearing a t-shirt and sweats. For a moment, she saw him as her little brother again, but that vision was blown apart by his haunted, hooded eyes. Eyes that resembled Abington's. "Hey, Carrie," Adam said as he trudged over to the fridge. "How'd the first surgery go?" "Pretty good," Carrie said. "Nobody died." Adam returned a fractured smile. "Well, I'd call that a big success." He chuckled. "Want some OJ?"
"Love some."
Adam poured two glasses and joined Carrie at the kitchen table. Carrie moved the flowers and card to the side to make room, surreptitiously checking her arms to make sure there were no visible marks or scratches. If her parents found out, they'd certainly be concerned about her safety, but Adam could go ballistic.
"Can I ask you something?"
Adam took a swig of OJ.
"Anything."
Carrie softened her voice.
"What do you think would happen if you saw a virtual reality simulation of something that happened to you over in Afghanistan?"
"What do you mean by that? Like a computer simulation?"
"Along those lines," Carrie said, "but hyper-realistic."
Adam tossed his hands in the air.
"I don't know."
Carrie thought not only of Abington's initial assault, but of his second outburst after the surgery, which required a haloperidol drip to calm him. Having experienced Adam's explosive temper, it was not a stretch to envision her brother in Abington's place.
"Could you maybe become violent?" Carrie asked.
This was a sensitive subject for the family. Adam owned several guns, including a pistol and rifle, and threatened to move out before he'd give them up. He was a lawful and responsible gun owner, and nobody disagreed, but nobody wanted him to have those weapons either. The worry was for Adam's safety, since PTSD and gun ownership were often a lethal mix. Adam returned an indifferent shrug.
"I hit a reporter for no real good reason, so I suppose anything is possible."
Carrie laughed. "Did she call to apologize?"
"I did better than that," Adam said. "I met the guy for coffee. Gave him everything he could possibly want to hear, and probably more than he expected."
Carrie made a mental note to call David Hoffman. She'd agreed to a coffee date as well. Seeing sadness in her brother's eyes, Carrie reached across the table and took hold of Adam's hand.
"Even I haven't heard those stories."
Adam squeezed her hand.
"For a reason.
If you ever want to talk about it."
"You're here for me. I know that, Carrie. You've always had my back."
He raised his hands in a pantomime of a pneumatic drill.
"Hey, what do you think of this work you're doing? Should I have you drill into my head and stick me with wires?"
Adam gave a cartoon evil scientist's maniacal laugh. Based on Abington's reaction to the treatment, Carrie could not say with certainty, but she still believed in the program and its promise. It might be worth the pain of reconsolidating bad memories through virtual reality therapy to get positive results, though Carrie had reason to worry about potential side effects. Her mind picked at the odd verbal exchange with Abington right before he went off the rails. The man's voice had sounded so distressed as he repeated, "Follow my light, follow my light." It was like he heard my voice in his head over and over again, Carrie thought. "I don't know yet," she said to Adam. "I need more time to see it in action before I can say, though I do think there's tremendous promise." Adam swallowed his orange juice in a long gulp and pushed back his chair to stand.
"I'm beat."
He stretched and yawned.
"Hi, beat, I'm Carrie."
She held out her hand and Adam shook it, smiling at their long-running joke.
"Have a good night. I'll see you in the morning."
"Night, Carrie."
At the doorway, Adam paused and turned.
"Hey, it's good to have you here. It's good for all of us."
Carrie blew him a kiss. When are you going to take me for a ride in that Camaro of yours?
I almost got it running today.
Carrie grimaced as she recalled the last time Adam almost got it running. Adam noticed her reaction.
Don't worry, he said. I'm not gonna go all Christine on it.
Christine, the film adaptation of the Stephen King novel, was Adam's favorite movie these days. He'd seen it on cable after he came home from the war. He was referring to the scene when the high school kids trashed the car named Christine, using aluminum bats, only to be killed after the car magically repaired itself and sought revenge. Adam seemed to like the idea of a thing that was indestructible, perhaps because he felt so vulnerable. Good night, Adam, Carrie said, crossing the room to give her brother a warm embrace. God, she hoped the DBS treatment worked. She hoped it was the cure for PTSD. She wanted her brother to feel whole again, but he was more like his Camaro he could not get running than Christine, which could magically put itself back together again. Upstairs in her bedroom, Carrie went to put her phone on the dresser and saw by the display that she'd missed a call during her drive home.
Dr. Bryant, this is Marianne from the VA. You asked me to call if there was any problem with patient Abington. He was rushed down to the medical ICU by a nurse and Dr. Goodwin's staff. Abington developed an arrhythmia and his blood pressure fell. The monitor showed ventricular tach with a wide QRS. I'm sorry to have to leave you this message. I tried you a couple times, but I couldn't reach you.
Carrie felt her own heart start to race. She checked the call log, and sure enough, two missed calls from the VA, including the call where Marianne had left her the voice message. Carrie muttered to herself, Haloperidol, damn it. She probably should have just given Abington more Valium, since it was already in his system from before. Except she had checked his ECG, and the QT interval was not prolonged or anything, and it had calmed him down. She felt physically ill. She had made the call, she had ordered the drug, and Steve Abington in the ICU was on her. Carrie thought of other ways she could have handled the situation, but kept returning to the haloperidol. He had seemed so crazy, beyond agitated. She had never experienced a post-op patient with symptoms resembling anything like Abington's. His repeating the same phrase and that look in his eyes? That was fear and terror she saw. It was different from the confused, agitated state or delirium she'd seen time and time again, whether someone was in the throes of DTs or suffering the consequences of acute stroke or sepsis or, well, a host of other medical and surgical disorders. This was something unique, and she did not know what to make of it. What else could have caused the arrhythmia? A hemorrhage? Goodness, that was always a risk after surgery. And Carrie had seen at least one case where a subarachnoid hemorrhage had resulted in a serious arrhythmia. While negative drug reaction remained the most probable event, other considerations besides a hemorrhage dotted her thoughts. It could be an infection, fever, perhaps a seizure, or even a stroke. A CT of the brain would be the logical first step. However, she could do nothing about it now. Abington's welfare was in the hands of the Med-ICU team. Before she could do anything, Abington needed to be stabilized. His blood pressure, heart rhythm, vital signs in general had to be under control. To go barging in there at this late hour would be counterproductive. They would take all the necessary precautions. She could picture Abington lying in an ICU bed, intubated again and hooked to a ventilator, IV fluids and antiarrhythmic drugs flowing through his veins, dopamine and other vasopressors keeping his blood pressure up. The baton had been passed. Abington was not a neurosurgical post-op case any longer. Still, she would go see him first thing in the morning. Chapter 22. It was dark when the alarm went off. Cocooned in her bed, Carrie thought about hitting the snooze button, but decided to get an early start. Despite the aches in her body and neck, the result of a buildup of lactic acid and inflammation, she managed to arrive at the VA a little after 7:30. She wanted to check on Abington before her day officially started. Even though the Med ICU staff was more than capable, she had done the invasive procedure and felt ultimately responsible for his outcome. It could be that all she did was give him her thanks and a pat on the back, but she had to do something. Either way, she had to know the outcome. Carrie had just flashed her security badge at the front desk when her phone began to vibrate. To her surprise, it was a text message from Dr. Sandra Goodwin, head of neurosurgery. Come see me as soon as you arrive. I'm in my office now. The text came across as a bit etchy. Carey belonged to Dr. Finley, head of neurology and his DBS program, so even though surgery resided under Dr. Goodwin's purview, the line of responsibility to her was a dotted one, at most. And thus far, Carey had had little interaction with the woman. Still, Abington could wait. Carey stopped by the cafeteria for coffee before making her way to Dr. Goodwin's second-floor office. Seated behind a metal desk that had probably been manufactured in the 1970s, Dr. Goodwin eyed Carey with contempt. Carey had not expected to see Dr. Evan Navarro, who ran the residency program, there as well. Navarro sat on one of two uncushioned folding chairs set in front of Dr. Goodwin's desk. The concrete brick walls were painted a sorry shade of yellow, and the low ceiling covered with cheap acoustic tiles made Carey feel uncomfortably confined. Other than a couple of struggling plants, Dr. Goodwin's home away from home had all the life of a pathology lab. Dr. Navarro turned the chair next to him slightly and offered it to Carey. She sat down gingerly, which had more to do with Navarro's hard stare than with her aching knee. Dr. Navarro was short, Carey probably had 2 inches on him, but he had a reputation for being pugnacious and for bringing residents to tears. His dark hair was gelled back, showing off a prominent widow's peak. Dr. Goodwin looked every bit her 55 years. She wore her hair in a bob that called attention to her face's sharp features, and nothing warm or fuzzy showed in her hazel eyes. She was all business and all about maximizing every minute in her day. Wearing a white lab coat over a set of blue scrubs, her clothing implied she would touch a scalpel at some point in the day, which Carey highly doubted. Dr. Goodwin was an administrator, but maybe she liked looking the part of a surgeon. Dr. Goodwin spoke bluntly.
I heard you went to see Steve Abington in the neuro recovery floor yesterday.
No, hello. No, how are you adjusting to the new job? No, I heard you almost got killed. Dr. Goodwin was as efficient with her words as she was with her time. I did. Carey did not know what else to say. Dr. Goodwin's glowering expression said that the chief of neurosurgery did not approve.
Yes, I see, Dr. Goodwin replied. I heard about yesterday, and I'm aware of the circumstance. I'm sorry that happened, though I do believe Dr. Finley expressed to you beforehand that the PTSD patients should never be seen without accompaniment.
Carey felt a bit ashamed by the accusation, but she bristled. It sounded like victim blaming. I guess I didn't fully appreciate the need for the warning, Carey said.
That may be, Dr. Goodwin replied coldly. And because of the extenuating circumstances here, Evan and I thought it would be appropriate to review our department policies with you with respect to post-op care, among other things.
That's the job of the residents, Navarro said in a sharp tone. You may think of yourself as one of the gang, but you're not.
Dr. Goodwin shot Navarro an admonishing look, perhaps to call back her attack dog.
What Evan is trying to say, Carey, is that you are basically an employee of Dr. Finley. Your situation here is highly unique. Unusual is the word I would choose to describe it. To be blunt, the hospital has a well-organized residency program, and you're not a part of it. Surely you understand that we have procedures in place for patient care and a hierarchy for addressing emergent situations. You show your face, and nurses don't know who to call if there's a problem. Do they call you? You're not even insured here if something does go wrong. You expose this program to added risk by this behavior.
Carrie's face felt hot.
I was simply curious to see how my first DBS patient was doing.
That's understandable, Dr. Goodwin said, which is why we're having a friendly chat about it. Doesn't feel friendly, Carey thought.
If the residents think you're undermining them, it will throw my entire program into disarray, Navarro said.
It was certainly not my intention.
Yes, well, our best intentions may have unintended consequences.
Well, how is Abington doing? Carey asked.
All I know is that he was moved to medical ICU.
And that's all you need to know, Navarro answered curtly.
Dr. Goodwin held her hand up again. Navarro apparently needed an even shorter leash.
I guess I'm a bit confused, Carey said. I just wanted to see how my patient was doing after my surgery.
Dr. Goodwin's intense expression ticked up a few notches.
Let me take a moment to clarify your role here, she said. You are the DBS surgeon, period. You did your surgery just fine. Dr. Finley brought you on board exclusively for that purpose, and I, for one, did not support your appointment.
No kidding.
I would have preferred we bring in somebody who had gone through a formal residency program successfully, Dr. Goodwin continued. But Dr. Finley is the one who has the funds, and he insisted your skills as a surgeon trumped any concerns we may have had regarding your unfortunate history. Carrie tensed at the reference, and in doing so caused a stab of pain in her aching knee. Your job is to do the DBS installations, and that's it, Dr. Goodwin said. And the next link in that chain is me, Navarro added. Carrie felt like she had just been body slammed. So, you see, Carrie, you're here because the DBS surgeries are lengthy and do require a dedicated resource. You're quite simply a hired hand, and it's best if you keep your involvement to that. Carrie's cheeks flushed. She could feel her anger starting to percolate. Digging deep, she mustered restraint. I understand. She directed her attention to Navarro. Would you mind giving me an update on Abington's condition? I understand he's been moved to the medical ICU. I did the procedure. I feel a responsibility for the patient outcome. I think I deserve that professional courtesy. Dr. Goodwin and Navarro exchanged an inscrutable look. Let's make sure we got this clear, Carrie, Dr. Goodwin said. You do the surgery and you're done. The residents and Dr. Navarro will do the post-op care. If a patient is moved to another unit, that patient becomes the responsibility of others, not us. We take care of our responsibilities as they apply to neurosurgery and do not go chasing after patients when they become the province of a different department. This is the way our organization is effectively maintained. Do I make myself clear? Carrie was shocked. She could not believe the tone Dr. Goodwin was using with her, the utter disdain. It was as if Carrie, by acting in a thoughtful and caring manner toward a patient, had violated some sacred oath and thereby single-handedly put the entire system in a state of dysfunctional disrepair. Carrie knew all about turfing, the idea that a patient who was moved off one floor and brought to another became OPP, other people's problem. But she had never worked in an environment where the hush-hush practice was so openly supported and, in fact, endorsed. The notion made Carrie sick to her stomach. This was not what she had signed up for, and she had every intention of making her feelings known to Dr. Finley. For now, the best, most politically expedient strategy for this meeting was to appear compliant and retreat. Never poke an angry bear. You've made yourself clear, Carrie said. So if I'm not scheduled to do any DBS surgeries, what then? As long as you respect our procedures, that is not my concern. You do what you feel is best for you and your career, Carrie, Dr. Goodwin said. Dr. Goodwin's smile held all the warmth of a snow cone. Carrie didn't have to be told to stand. This meeting was clearly adjourned. Chapter 23 Carrie spent 15 minutes in her cramped, windowless office trying to decompress. Her blood pressure had settled, but she was having enormous trouble concentrating on her DBS research. She was halfway through a difficult paper on dysarthria and Parkinson's disease, but the words jumbled on the page. She was ruminating on that contentious conversation, ambush was more like it, with Doctors Goodwin and Navarro. The insinuations were absolutely infuriating. Carrie had not taken the job just to be a surgical tool, a hammer for a nail, so to speak. Dr. Finley had told her she'd be part of the team, and that was how she'd envisioned her role. I would have preferred we bring in someone who had gone through a formal residency program successfully. Dr. Goodwin's words bit hard. Out of frustration, Carrie balled up the printout she'd been reading and threw it against the wall. That woman had been cutting, disparaging, and downright offensive. Something odd had happened with Steve Abington, something potentially related to his DBS treatment. It was more than the agitated state the duty nurse had described. This was something, but what? She was focused mostly on his strange response. In her mind, she could still hear him muttering the same phrase over and over again, repeating what she had said. Follow my light, follow my light. Abington seemed to experience some form of auditory hallucination. It was unusual, not the type she had seen in schizophrenics, where disturbing voices outside the head seemed to speak directly to victims. She was keen to try and understand. Even if she were prohibited from